Malloy here. Time for another story, and another trip through the Wind Door. Hello, listeners. Thank you for joining us on another trip through the Wind Door. The original plan was to talk about chapters 10 through 13 of Secret Rooms. It's only after both Toby and I reviewed it, and I ended up having a lot of thoughts and a couple of side conversations with a little bit with Alex and a little bit with Toby, that I think we're going to try and give Chapter 13 its own episode, which is going to be an unusual...
It needs more breathing space.
Yes, it does in fact need more breathing space. There's going to be a lot of weighty topics that are going to come up, because as is obvious if you've read this far, one of the major developments of the next few chapters is that we get introduced to our first speaking part of a non-white character. On top of that, since originally recording, we have had the fresh round of police violence that's taken the lives of George Floyd and Breonna Taylor, who are only the most recent victims of the violent actions of militarized and racist cops, not to mention the surge of physical and verbal assaults imposed on black people by white supremacist citizenry. No one is in doubt where Toby and I stand. Like Alex and Sharon, we deplore all of these actions and the people that aid and abet them. All of us want to do our best to stand up for those that are especially vulnerable during this time. We have always tried to be considerate and sensitive during the run of Through the Wind Door. There are elements from our original conversations that are going to be modified or removed as a result. Trump is not a joke. He is a clear and present danger to America, and so are any of the state and federal organizations he has influenced during his time in office. But first and foremost, I want this to be a place where other people can enjoy themselves. That said, the story of New Century is by its nature very political, so it's not as if I can avoid talking about these things either. And given the fact that silence implies acceptance, I would never want to be too quiet about these things. But if you feel that there is anything that we need to address or correct in particular, contact info will be in the show notes. That's our disclaimer. Let's return to the meat of our discourse. Because obviously Nathan was someone that was in the background of some of those introductory episodes, but he was merely a presence and color commentary about things as they went on, and not so much a character in his own right. Meanwhile, as the characters come into New Athens and we are seeing the interactions of our heroes with the Sheriff Sampson, as well as interaction between Sampson and other people in their community, and how all of those things sort of come to a head, specifically in Chapter 13 with race relations and potential discussions of cycles of abuse and just a whole lot of other things. I want to make sure to be able to handle that carefully, as may not be necessarily obvious because this is a podcast rather than a YouTube video or anything like that. Me and Toby are very white. It's true that I do have Mexican ancestry only two steps removed. My father is half, and until high school grew up in Mexico. I still have extended family for whom their Mexican heritage is a significant part of their life. But I look white, I am fairly light-skinned, and I don't have a Latino last name or an accent. For all intents and purposes, I have white privilege, and have never faced any of the issues my father experienced when he was young, let alone other members of my family. And even if I had incorporated more of Mexican culture into the way I interact with the world, it still would not qualify me to speak for the experience of black people in America. So I am going to see if I can get somebody else in to potentially discuss some of these items. At the very least, I'm talking with some of my friends on Twitter and asking them questions so that we come better prepared to that particular conversation.
And I imagine that by the time you are hearing this, it would probably be too late for us to recruit anyone who wants to come forward for Chapter 13's episode. But by that doesn't stop us wanting to have as many voices involved in this project as possible. So it's not a timed opportunity that we're saying, okay, once we get past chapter 13, we'll never want to do anyone other than us two again. Like, of course not. We want to get as many people involved as possible.
And besides that, chapter 13 is really only the beginning of this conversation. It's the first time it's come up. As you get into certain aspects of the Cartographer's Handbook, and more specifically Arlington, where black characters and what they're doing and what they're thinking, what their experiences are in particular, start becoming a major focal point of storytelling, then our desire to get other people's feedback and opinions and voices potentially on the podcast will be, you know, even more than ever. It's something I was waiting around in and putting feelers out for, just to see if there was anybody in the current New Century fan base that would be interested in stepping up to talk about it. Anyway, that's digressing. Let's start getting into the meat of what's going on here. I feel, and I think Toby will back me up on this, that Chapter 10 is where the story of New Century and the plot, it starts to get really meaty. It's now less about an introduction of our main characters and our mentor characters, and more about actually interacting and learning stuff about the world, instead of being, you know, the new fish suddenly being dumped into the wider world. Toby's initial response to this was suggesting that things were moving beyond an earlier simple black and white assertion of human good, Wendigo bad. And while it's true that the Wendigo are not, thus far, a people that can be interacted with on a non-violent basis, I'd actually say that there was never a time when humanity was considered universally good within the text of this narrative. And that's true no matter what your starting point is. If your first book was the Cartographer's Handbook, the various vignettes make very clear that some of the stories told were done so by unsavory people, or you may have heard of outcomes showing how people not working from a place of empathy and compassion utterly collapsed. If you've been following us since Let Them Go, you've already heard us speak extensively on toxic behaviors in men in Old World UK. And even if your first book was the original printing of Secret Rooms, you would have heard the tale of Catherine and the people of Weirwood fighting off bandits, showing a significant number of men more than happy to take from others rather than work together for continued survival. But Toby does rightfully point out that in the new context of the flashback chapters, Alex does prepare us for the turn of events in Chapter 10.
We did see our first indication that things would go in this direction in an earlier chapter in this book when Abigail is talking with her father about his motivations and his thoughts on his role in the Civil War, and how he doesn't necessarily have an answer to every question that Abigail has about the ethics of what he did. And even though he had good intentions, that he was still part of something much larger that had a hell of a lot of baggage to it, to put it mildly. I think that is what is going on here with Butler, is that, like Abigail's father, he is in a sort of position of authority, or someone who James turns to. He has more experience than James does in this world, so he has to kind of tell him how things are, and when he does, it's not entirely satisfactory. And that kind of, it's a good way of showing how these extra chapters, which I'll keep saying it, the extra chapters of this definitive edition of Secret Rooms, it brings into focus what the thematic weight of the original narrative is.
One of the drawbacks, I feel, of doing things in this order, but I guess it didn't really occur to me until we actually started rereading and looking at these things, is that while I didn't have much of an issue jumping into some of this stuff in this particular order, where I was reading and were rather listening to Secret Rooms before the Cartographer's Handbook, there are definitely details in the Cartographer's Handbook that would I perhaps have benefited from knowing before jumping into some of this stuff. Let Them Go does prepare us a little bit for this particular scenario, where we have been introduced to the monster known as the Barghest or the Wendigo, and therefore we know some things about them. But we're also, in that particular book, we're seeing them through a very different lens. The Cartographer's Handbook is unusual in that this book exists inside the world it talks about. The original World War Z was vignettes taken from survivors of a fictional zombie apocalypse from beginning to end. Here, the vignettes are not a story in and of themselves. They are part of a new historical narrative by the reunified states of America. The actual purpose of the handbook is meant to be both inspirational to those the cartographers would read it to, but also attempting to establish a new order. A new order means new rules, laws, directives. The book does try to give people enough information to explain why the President and Thomas Arlington feel these are important, but it also doesn't really give room for debate. These upcoming chapters are essentially seeing different reactions to this new order, or in James's case, some of the facts in the book asserted as gospel. Secret Rooms gives you enough to infer what the book says, but it also doesn't give you the whole context. We'll talk about that context in detail when we eventually cover the handbook. With that all covered for now, let's talk more about James's reactions in Chapter 10. As established by the handbook, the Wendigo are monsters. They kill and attack people, and they're basically wild animals. Well, not just wild animals, because wild animals still have structures that we understand from a certain perspective, even if it's not quite the same necessarily as we would understand these things today after decades and decades of dedicated research. It's harder to know how much people knew back then, but I also don't want to call people back then stupid or anything like that. It's just that when you get your civilization up to a certain point, it allows for a lot more time and a lot more bodies and a lot more intercessing conversation where you're sharing information and therefore learning a great deal more about individual subjects because you can dedicate time and energy to that kind of thing.
To add insult to injury, we can only imagine the amount of information that has been lost thanks to the Wendigo. Some of it may be recoverable, sure, as the retaking of cities will result in the retaking of libraries. But that will not account for the information and intelligence and insight that was housed and utilized inside individual people. People whose experience could have been further collected, shared, and built on. There will be new century heroes in the areas of science and technology, as evidenced by the Vox tubes. But that's not the same as the kind of years of study and re-evaluating of biases that has led to, say, an understanding that wolves don't actually behave in the alpha male hierarchies that we have always ascribed them to in popular culture. And that's something that's only been resolved recently in the 21st century.
My point is that right up until recently, the Wendigo were basically considered, you know, even because of the names that they give to this monster, Goblin, Barghest, Wendigo, it's viewed as the thing in the night that has no purpose but to come and either eat you or turn you into one of them. It is a monster in the literal sense of the word, rather than something that's easier to comprehend, like a deer or a wolf or a bear or anything like that. It's terrifying because it doesn't obey any of the normal laws that people of that time would have gotten used to in terms of dealing with actual animals.
And so they had to draw upon colloquial folklore and these older concepts of things that are unknowable monsters with sharp teeth, the sort of things that, you know, the opening song number of Nightmare Before Christmas would have, like, probably be including, like, the I am the thing hiding under your bed. It's very much that sort of, it's drawing upon things which, even if there are these terms, the things like goblins and wendigos and barghest, it's almost nameless, but nevertheless understood and felt, like, you know what that thing is, even if you can't specifically concretely identify it as it is this creature that goes by these habits. You still know what it is because it is this monster that you once upon a time humans may have known about, but they have forgotten about it.
Most of Alex's audience are likely pretty familiar with the average mindless zombie thanks to a glut of popular media. But for both longtime fans of the series and those that just started with Let Them Go, the usual Wendigo encounter tends to feel a lot more like this.
It can't be bargained with. It can't be reasoned with. It doesn't feel pity or remorse or fear. And it absolutely will not stop. Ever. Until you are dead.
That's the mindset that the author trusts that she'll be in now that these things have been introduced to you, so that when we start getting into chapter 10 and James is doing his Sherlock Holmes thing where he's picking apart the scene of where this last stand happened and deciding that, okay, I've been able to figure out where the nest of Wendigos probably are. Let's go in and deal with them so we've at least destroyed one more threat. And
he's activating detective vision.
Yes. He's Batman activating detective vision. I'm sorry, that's another a video game reference there for those of you that are not familiar. Where the cartographer's handbook would help get it set up in everybody's mind. This is the way these things are. This is how you need to deal with them. Here, Secret Room specifically relies on your understanding of these things to be like, okay, so maybe you haven't read the cartographer's handbook yet, but you know about zombies, right? Basically treat these like zombies. Zombies don't have social orders. Zombies don't have layers in which, like, they all hole up in, you know, in order to avoid the elements or eat food or socialize or have things like offspring.
I should clarify this original assertion that when I say lairs, I mean communal lairs. Any solitary predator would still have a place of safety that it returns to.
Like a lair implies that they would go there to do something other than go out and eat people, which is very antithetical to what the sort of threat of zombies are, which is that they are single-minded.
So all of a sudden, James is rightfully angry and frustrated that he feels that information was kept from him. And that leads to a very interesting conversation between James and Frank.
Well, what would you do?
If wiping them out is what is required for the human race's survival, then so be it. But we need to be in possession of the facts. Withholding something like this makes the cartographer's handbook less of an authentic historical document and more like propaganda.
Look, they're acting like people. Why are we not treating them like potential people? And Frank comes back at it with, look, they've already almost killed all of us. You think that if we were able to actually have communication with them, that we might have successfully done so by now? I mean, we've been doing this longer than you have. That specific conversation doesn't happen, but if you read between the lines a little bit, there is the overall implication that just because there are things that we can't explain about the Wendigo, things that would suggest that maybe engaging on a quest to destroy the Wendigo utterly might be far more like certain colonialist behaviors or behaviors of powerful nation when dealing with smaller tribes or aborigines or anything like that.
I mean, to be completely direct, if they were zombies and, you know, a threat, it's like, okay, we have to eliminate the threat. That's as far as the conversation goes. This creates a turning point where it becomes for the first time akin to genocide.
Mm-hmm.
And it's worth noting that the key sort of detail that James is getting hung up on is that there is a child and I think a mother holding the body of a child, and he cites the information that the handbook claims when the Wendigo has access to no other source of food, they will actually turn on themselves and tear themselves to shreds. And this is clearly evidence that they don't do that. And this is the most sort of cut straight to the emotional heart by showing a mother and their child. Mm-hmm. It just shows immediately there is some level of empathy here. And if there is at least some, like, the possibility for these creatures to feel the capacity to empathize with one another and care for one another, that they do not kill their family, even if it means starving to death, then that has implications that can go to horrifying conclusions, given what the human race has to do.
I like the overall idea that this interaction and these revelations suddenly make what is far more, what would be far more, as you say, far more cut and dried with a zombie outbreak, suddenly adds a level of complexity that makes us wonder about if Frank, and by extension Arlington, is actually right in deciding to do what they're doing. It brings us to more of a complicated place. There was an article on the gaming news website Polygon that came out about 2 weeks ago suggesting that video games need to return to a black and white morality. One of the arguments offered is that gray morality undercuts storytelling and suggests that everyone is a hair away from being bad or good. And a story in which Captain America remains true to his ideals in a world of gray moralities is far more inspiring. Naturally, there was a lot of outcry about this article, particularly when they used the video game Undertale as a game where you choose between good and evil morality, and someone immediately points out that no, it's actually possible to finish the game without going all pacifist choices or all murderous choices. But the thing that I want to take away from that article is this. The temptation to frame things in a completely good or evil light is understandable. It makes things uncomplicated. It helps provide an assurance that what we are doing is unquestionably the right thing to do, no matter how dubious it may seem. But life is complex, and telling stories that completely strip away that complexity is doing a disservice to the audience and to what it can teach us. One of my favorite moments about this comes from the fourth season of West Wing, where President Bartlet is in a televised debate and has a moment of epiphany that the simple answers to a debate question that are so highly prized are toxic, because they provide a simple response to something that will always have a complex resolution. To suggest that a black and white morality should be prized is a false binary. The world is complicated, and nothing a politician says will change that. As the president's press secretary points out in a scene moments later,
I mention this because the president just reminded us that complexity isn't a vice.
Having said all this, I would add a caveat. This part of the story was also written before Trump got elected, and certain parts of the U.S. felt emboldened and freed to indulge in harmful behavior. The world being complex doesn't mean that empathy doesn't have a limit, or that we should not decry certain kinds of behavior. Only that choices should be made with proper consideration, rather than from a knee-jerk or simplistic morality. Let Them Go has even primed us for this. While we ascribed meaning to the final confrontation symbolically, it's impossible not to wonder what it means practically as well, what the Wendigo truly are, and what is exactly going on in the world that set all this in motion. As Toby goes on to say,
new details are coming to light and will continue to come to light, and I think that this moment in the cave is that sort of significant turning point where the implications of this, I think James understands that this is going to be very important for not only where his journey will take him, but where the human race's journey will take them.
Mm-hmm. In this particular case, where the cartographer's handbook is meant to be inspiring to what remains of the American nation. While James makes the argument that the handbook as written feels more like propaganda if it doesn't have all the facts in there, on some level it sort of has to be propaganda, because it isn't just rallying a nation to come together and have empathy for one another in order to deal with this ongoing threat. It requires painting the Wendigo as the implacable enemy.
Obviously, we'll talk a lot more about the actual contents of the handbook when we cover it in a couple of months. I know that using the word propaganda is a loaded term, because it often uses charged language and selective facts free of context in order to provoke an emotional response rather than a rational one. But regardless of how transparent the handbook is, how many truths it contains, we have established in Frank's words that it does not contain all the truth. It contains just enough facts to encourage people to make rational choices to obey the new order. More importantly, to believe that putting themselves in harm's way is absolutely necessary for humanity's survival. The handbook is still a biased narrative. It's just that in this case, the goal is to inspire hope, and through hope, actually bring humanity back from the brink.
Any additional information that, as Frank would say, that confuses that is not helpful.
Frank's role in this scene is to sort of illustrate the point of the book as propaganda without it sounding utterly reprehensible. Because up to this point, Frank has been the upstanding guy who's very easy for the characters and the audience to like. So for him to be actually espousing, yeah, okay, this isn't ideal, but we kind of need it. Mm-hmm. It does create this strange situation where you question not only is this propaganda something that needs to happen, but you also question whether Butler really is the ideal person that up till now he has seemed as this great soldier, great leader, very sort of friendly, looking after James and everything like that. So the fact that James actually directly calls him on his hypocrisy when he says, didn't you just say that the truth will out and now you're telling me to stop encouraging the spread of truth? And he doesn't really have an answer for that, in much the same way that Abigail's father didn't really have a concrete answer to all of Abigail's questions. It's one of many parallels that are drawn between the events of the quote-unquote present, everything that goes on with James and Abigail as adults, and the events of the past, the like time, their time at Werewood, their upbringing from their parents, all of these actions carrying forward and them possibly spotting other people who kind of remind them of their past, or maybe it's just for the audience to notice those parallels.
Well, then let's go on to talk about some of that, because that's part of some of the same theme that this first topic brought up. So moving on to another part of the chapters that we're covering thus far, where Abigail is talking about her experiences with her father, specifically with Tabitha.
Then one day, when I was 11, after years of my nagging, he took me up on a hill, not too far from here now. Just this quiet, sunny day on a hill with my daddy. And he told me everything, all at once. Just this unending stream of horror imparted to my little mind while the birds chirped away in the trees. And after that couple of hours, I was no longer fascinated by war. He had this cold, detached view of it, and his eyes were far away the whole time. Then when he came back, I hugged him and apologized from the very bottom of my heart for my years of endless, insensitive questioning. That was when he taught me to fight. After that, we'd go up on the hill, and he'd square off against me. My daddy was a boxer. He could hit hard, and he wasn't satisfied till I was hitting back just as hard as he was. We used to come back down with black eyes and split lips and, hey, look, he knocked out this tooth one time. My mother used to go off at us both something fierce, but I was the toughest kid in town.
He starts treating her more as an adult able to handle complicated ideas. As a direct result of that, decides that, okay, now that I've introduced to you all of these complicated, gray, difficult concepts,
please believe me when I say that I was not trying to make a pun about the family surname. It just came out that way.
I feel like it's now my responsibility to see to it that, like, I've already gone out of my way to no longer protect you from your childhood and, you know, brought you into a wider world where there aren't always any good, clean answers, even if that on some level comes back to bite him when, you know, in those early chapters, Abigail is saying, look, you've told me all of these things now, and I have some fucking opinions. And her father's just like, yeah. Okay, I let myself in for that, but, you know, if I didn't want you to be able to
think for yourself... Left myself wide open for that.
I wanted you to be able to think for yourself, so, you know, I'll take the hit and you know, give you your victory on that.
Well, that's exactly the thing, is that your phrasing is perfect, actually, because from how Abigail talks about how she learned to fight, it was he would throw her a punch and then she would give him a punch, and he, like, for as much as he was, like, throwing punches at his own daughter, he was getting the shit kicked out of him, too. Mm. So he's someone who will actually take hits from the people he's engaging with. So when Abigail throws that sort of philosophical punch her way, for as clumsy as that metaphor is, I think it's like... Yeah, you know what? That's a good throw you did there. That's like fair enough, and it's like they're coming to blows in more than one sense. Sorry about that. When it goes roaring past the window there.
Oh, for a second there, I thought it was a whale trying to communicate with you and let us know that aliens were coming.
Things aren't at that point yet, but yeah, we'll see.
different genre, but yeah, no, that's actually a really good, like, I wasn't even necessarily thinking about it until you put my own words back at me there. When Abigail is talking to Tabitha about her getting fighting training from her father and about it getting really serious in terms of knocked out teeth and bruises and everything like that, honestly, the thing that it reminded me the most of, and because it's like one of the few things in media that I've experienced that is any way similar. There is a video game that I played called Assassin's Creed Odyssey. There are many Assassin's Creed games out there, but this specific one is different from a lot of the previous in that it takes place basically during ancient Greek time. More specifically, 5th century Athens, what is known as the Age of Pericles. This was the era in which such notaries as Socrates, Hippocrates, and Herodotus lived, as well as many notable Greek playwrights we still talk about today. Which is important, because your protagonist will meet most of these Greek luminaries in one form or another. You can choose to experience the story as a female protagonist throughout the entire game. This is something new for that brand, and I'm trying very hard not to get into the whys of that, as well as the general obscene fuckery of the Assassin's Creed parent company, so look up the recent Ubisoft news yourself if you don't know already. The moment of relevance to Abigail is that regardless of if you play male or female, early in the game you get to see a flashback of combat training with your father, a heroic Spartan general. That makes, if you choose to play a woman in that game and you're seeing this 10-year-old, 11-year-old Spartan girl engaging in sparring with her father, who is encouraging her on and also treating her as an opponent worthy of respect in terms of not holding back or anything like that. That's what came up the most for me when rereading that entire section.
I'm also pretty sure that this was intended. The game in question came out long after Alex wrote this, but the Elder Grey's familiar name is Hector, an unusual name that invokes one of the princes and greatest warriors of Troy
in the epic Greek poem, The Iliad, and hearing about Abigail's father getting into literal punch-ups, but it's the only way he can figure out how to make her prepared for the world, because this isn't play, this is actual training. And, you know, as I have heard said colloquially, pain is a hell of a motivator. But he's not playing the part of being the asshole drill sergeant either. He is not trying to egg people on and make them angry or feel bad about themselves in order to drive them to do better. He's just giving as good as he can get and letting her give as good as she can give, in order to give her the proper experience she needs so that she can deal with actual combat.
Well, it's really important that she is able to get those punches on him, because for as much as he is treating her as an opponent and she's taking these hits, the fact that she is able to fight back is a way of showing her that for as much as the world will beat down on her, she can fight back and kick the ass of the people that she's fighting. So I think that to sort of show that she is able to stand on equal terms with the person who is instructing her is like one of the biggest confidence boosters in a way, where it's a case of, you can tell that I'm good at this, but you are just as good as this. And it's kind of this thing where, yeah, she really, of course she was going to be the toughest kid in town. She's able to go toe-to-toe with her old man.
Her old man who was a soldier, yeah.
Yeah, it's a sort of odd scenario. And I think that I appreciate that when Abigail is relaying all of this to Tabitha, that Tabitha responds in a way where, especially in the audio version, the tone with which she says, like, it sounds like that old girl that you were was beaten out of you. Yeah. She sort of says it without really a sense of approval. It's very much a case of like, that sounds like maybe not the best way to go about parenting, but I appreciate that there is a sort of certain kind of sense that this was something that made Abigail the hard ass, the badass that she is, but it also does carry with it a certain sense of like, this sounds sketchy, Abigail, I'm not gonna lie. It's like, what are you talking about, Tabitha? Mm-hmm.
This all ties back in with the earlier commentary on complexity. Toby and I originally had a longer drawn out conversation about it, but what it boils down to is that people don't always make the right decisions, and we should always question the answers given, because we owe it to ourselves to think critically about the things that will affect the future of ourselves and others. Even if we end up coming to the same conclusions, there is a danger in merely accepting the word of our elders or our leaders as gospel. Using that critical eye is important for us, the readers, and it's also going to be important in the short term and the long term for our heroes. I had been finishing a rewatch of the movie Knives Out earlier this evening, and there's a great line from Benoit Blanc that sums up the topics we have been discussing pretty pithily. The complexity and the gray lie not in the truth, but in what you do when you have it. I'm not going to spoil the movie, which is phenomenal and you should see it if you haven't already, but that's an axiomatic line that I had to nonetheless sit with a bit and let bubble into my brain. Later episodes are going to get into the symbolic nature of James and Abigail, and how those reflect on the thoughts they think and the actions they take, both now and in the past. But for this half episode, I'm going to call it early. It's as good enough a place as any to stop, and since I'm heading back into work this week, I can't stay up late Sunday night to further refine anyway. This summer has been a bear heat-wise, and I did not make as much progress on this episode as I wanted originally this week. Fortunately, if work continues to be dead, I expect I will be able to have something great for the following Monday. A White Scarves team with Loretta Sela, the voice of our very own Annie Oakley. Strap in, folks. She is a lot in the best of ways. To end the evening, discussion of the sparring between father and daughter put me in the mood for a song by Imagine Dragons. It's relatively recent, so it's very likely one that you have heard in one vein or another. Some of the lyrics are going to make more sense to those of you that have already finished the story, but the song itself is punchy and powerful, and feels like something that was written specifically for a trailer or the opening of an action-packed TV show. I give you Believer.
First things first, I'ma say all the words inside my head. I'm fired up and tired of the way that things have been. Oh, ooh, the way that things have been. Oh, ooh. Second thing, second, don't you tell me what you think that I can be. I'm the one at the sail, I'm the master of my sea. Oh, I was broken from a young age, taking my soak into the masses, writing my poems for the few that look at me, took to me, shook at me, feeling me, singing from heartache, from the pain, taking my message from the veins, speaking my lesson from the brain, seeing the beauty through the...
I want to stop. We can't.